Someday you will face the unimaginable. It is physically impossible to avoid it.
You got my attention, Mr. Wong.
This black stuff, this sauce.
You can see things you shouldn't be able to.
If I show you what's in this container, you'll never feel at one with the human race.
I realized all at once, my one chance to save the universe lay inside this bottle.
It'd be opening doors to other worlds, man.
What is that stuff, John?
The soy sauce?
That stuff. I'm remembering things that haven't happened yet.
We were chosen by the soy sauce.
So you guys are what? Some kind of spiritualist exorcists?
It's something like that.
The director of Phantasm and Bubba Hotep.
I suppose you are wondering where you are.
I'm gonna guess we're in an alternate universe of some kind.
Warns you to brandish your weapons.
Can I buy you a beer?
Lock your doors.
What the?
That's the axe that slayed me.
And stay away.
Ooh.
From red meat.
Right?
But whatever you do, don't spoil the ending.
Suppose you're wondering why I'm here.
I suppose you're wondering what I'm doing with this can of gasoline.
John! John!
John dies at the end.
Dave, this is John. Where are you right now?
Where are you? Heaven?
Is there any way that you can steal my body?
What?
Okay, here we are. We're back for another episode of Lucid Reviews with Saul and Adrian. And this time we watch John Dies at the End. John Dies at the End is a spastic, mind-boggling rampage of a film. And if you're into gore, the grotesque, psychedelic drugs, and sarcasm, then chances are you already know about it. But for those who aren't already familiar, director Don Cascarelli's screenplay is an adaptation of David Wong's novel by the same name. The source text has its roots as a web serial beginning in 2001, and over several years, the series gathered a substantial readership. The story and its characters are widely described as a horror parody, with nods to H.P. Lovecraft and the surrealism of Hieronymus Bosch paintings. The story centers around Dave as he recounts the story of his run-in with the drug soy sauce and the extra-dimensional entity known as Korok. The plot is delivered as a flashback and is embedded with snarky voiceover from Dave, which initially reminded me of film noir, but later seemed to be an imitation of comic book narratives. Paul Giamatti's skeptical writer character, Blondstone, is the viewer's tether to reality. For the most part, aside from Giamatti, the rest of the cast are unknowns. But they all deliver fitting performances for the film. The material doesn't seem to demand much more in the way of acting than an American Pie movie would, as most of the performance centers on perverse jokes and sight gags. But John Dies at the End does more than insinuate when it comes to crudeness, and while it may not be everyone's cup of tea, I can appreciate it for the honesty it represents in a time when that quality seems to be lacking in mainstream cinema. This movie stands out for the quips, the asinine characters, and the grotesque images. Your mind might be blown, a little bit, but more likely just a little tickled. Worth the watch, if even just to revisit a style of movie that hasn't been seen since the likes of Tank Girl or Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. If you've got low tolerance for narrative tangents, esoteric mumbo-jumbo, practical effect gore, or anything sarcastic and angsty a la Gen X, then John Dies at the End may not hold your attention very long. The story does seem like a patchwork of references to a significant moments in the series, which is problematic when you're trying to cram years of characters and backstory into 99 minutes. But as far as horror comedies go, John Dies at the End hits all the right marks.
That's now, pretty spot on. What do you think? There are a couple things I really like about that. I like that you used the word sarcasm. I don't know if you did, actually. That's what I heard. That's an appropriate word.
I didn't.
Sarcasm.
But I should have.
And I think that your point about the honesty of the film is, in a weird way, is, you know, and I'm not sure exactly what that means, honesty about the film, honesty as being a quality of it, but, like, it's not like the characters are particularly, like, revealing truths about themselves, or it's like, you know, talking about things that people don't usually talk about, but it seems to be more honest in the sense that it's not pretending that it's not a movie. It's very, you know, upfront, like, yeah, this is entertainment.
Right.
This isn't like, we're not trying to put on, you know, an alternate reality. It's not, this isn't, you know, it's just saying upfront, okay, go ahead, suspend your disbelief. This is a story. And that is something that is missing, especially because the function of movies nowadays seems to be more often to give people an escape from reality than to give them insight into reality.
I think what I meant by honesty too is that it's, like you said, it's not trying to be anything other than what it is. And whether, you know, to some extent it's pretty honest about the fact that we're watching a movie, but it's also the characters use vulgarity and language without any apologies. It's not strictly for shock value. You know, it's not a gimmick. Even though it's okay, so it may seem like trying to say that John dies at the end does not use gimmicks is a little detached from the whole premise of the movie. But that's what I got from it. That it was authentically that
right.
Shallow and crude.
The dick and fart jokes, in particular. I mean, I loved how they were used in the movie, just because it was casual and it wasn't, you know, there weren't any kind of particularly, there were some good ones in there, but they weren't, you know, like overly elaborate or like anything, there wasn't a big deal made about them. They were just, you know, the way that dumb people make dumb dick and fart jokes, myself included.
Yeah, and it's funny because The subject matter is pretty out there, pretty highbrow, abstract concepts. In fact, I could appreciate what I noticed was probably some decent research into the occult, you know, as fodder for this story. It wasn't just your run of the mill. Ghosts and goblins and possessions and stuff. They actually touched on some more of the bizarre elements of the occult and the supernatural. And but it doesn't dwell on anything long enough to really be pensive or to really be scary. You know, there's no tension. I never felt any tension in the movie. Maybe that's just because I was analyzing it too much. But, you know, I felt like the blistering pace of the movie that doesn't linger on anything long enough for it to really sink in. Instead, it just seems like it flies by.
For this kind of movie, yeah.
Which works.
Absolutely. It wasn't trying to blow your mind. But it was alluding to a lot of things that, you know, if you spent time with, either have blown your mind or might blow your mind.
Yeah. I remember the part of the sequence where he gets jabbed with the needle that has the soy sauce in it. He's in the car. And he basically has this psychedelic trip where he's like talking about, he's on the phone with a priest, and then the priest gets all demonic on him, and then it gets really weird, and then he like winds up having a, no, I'm sorry, this is later when he's at the house and the cop shows up with the gas can. Then he goes off into La La Land and has this monologue about quantum particles, and he just starts going down the rabbit hole talking about this out of body experience, and then he just stops and says, then I realized I wasn't in the house anymore. And it cuts. And now he's in this like wasteland, and there's a little girl walking by, and she turns and half her face is like missing.
Her eyes. Or she's gone. Like her,
you know. And that's what I mean about it not dwelling on anything long enough to really be deep. You know, if it had kept going for another 5 minutes about quantum particles and, you know, the all these theories to explain such a paranormal experience, it might have been too cerebral. But because it just like name drops that concept, like, yeah, I know about that. And it's almost like the writer is speaking and saying, hey, check this out. Hey, check out what I know about that. Check out what I know about this. And just throws it all, you know, the whole everything but the kitchen sink in there in the movie, and just kind of assumes that you either have a frame of reference for what he's talking about and can appreciate it, or you don't have any frame of reference and it all works as like a just like a tirade of
right. Abstraction. If you don't know what it's talking about, it just
which may
gives you a vague sense of like, you know, oh, this is out there, you know. And if you do get the references, it just shows a kind of a mutual understanding. I thought that actually displayed some respect for the audience that, you know, like, I don't have to like spell this out for you. Like, we're not watching a movie so that you're going to figure out the meaning of the reality and everything here. Like, you're here to be entertained. Let me draw on what you know. Which again comes back to the kind of honesty and the attitude towards it. It reminds me of, I'm reading a book by Philip Roth, Portnoy's Complaint, which has a really similar honesty in that it, you know, goes into all the sort of perverse thoughts that just like run through any adolescent boy's head, and without giving much, you know, without really, you know, stopping to like explain the significance of it or like, oh, you know, like defend like why there's all this perversion in the book. It sort of just like takes it for granted that the audience is going to acknowledge like, okay, this is just honest insight. Like, I can relate to this. You don't need to, you know, like spell it out for me. There was something else in your review that stuck out to me that I liked. It was somewhere in the middle. And I'm having a hard time remembering what it was.
The film noir, like flashback.
That was interesting.
Voiceover.
It being comic book kind of style. Yeah, but that wasn't it.
I got that when the voiceover was it was almost like a response to what was happening in the narrative, but a response directed only at the audience. You know, so it was like Dave's future commentary on what was happening at that moment. You know, I can't pick out a line, but you know, it just somebody would say something to Dave, and then you hear Dave respond, you know, in his head, and that to me stuck out as very comic book like, you know, because you get to basically hear his thoughts. Or, you know.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, it strikes me that the comic book, that kind of thread aside, coming back to what we were talking to earlier. Because this what at least what I'm focusing on is, you know, not just the, you know, all those references actually, the more I think about them, really do add up to a pretty consistent theme. And whether it's the, you know, quantum physics references or the you know, becoming the extra-dimensional references, or this idea of Korok, you know, this universal being sort of thing. There is this consistent thread related to identity that another line from the movie kind of struck me, too, as being really similar and worth mentioning. It's the one where he meets the Robert Marley, who gives him the soy sauce for the first time. If you remember, he interprets, or he, you know, he offers to interpret this guy's dreams without, you know, hearing what the dream is. And he goes ahead and tells him about this dream he had where, you know, at the end of the dream, an explosion turns into lightning, into a thunderstorm outside as he's waking up. And how did his brain know that the thunderstorm was going to start at that exact moment? You know, because the dream started 30 seconds before the thunderstorm. And that sense that we're, you know, something's operating in our mind that's not here. It's not just in this skull, in this head, or in this body. And I mean, there is, it's interesting in the way that, in the same way that a comic book can present things in a sort of casual manner, or it's like a very, you know, it's not trying to emulate reality very seriously. It's meant to be an artistic rendition of reality. You know, this movie does a similar thing where, like, even the special effects are, like, they're not meant to be super convincing. They're pretty funny and pretty out there, over the top. But somehow that effect actually it works better than if it had tried to take on that issue of identity straight on and seriously, because it is one of those things, like those demons in the movie, that you only can catch when you're looking at it out of the corner of your eye. You know, as soon as you look at it right on, it changes and it disappears. You can't really see yourself. You can't see your true identity, because
I mean, this movie is ugly. I felt that its aesthetic was pretty, like, jarring and not pleasant to look at. I think a lot of sci-fi, fantasy, special effects driven stuff tries to look pretty at the same time. You know, it tries to look very polished. Even while it may be supposed to be horrific, frightening, whatever, it's also trying to do so with a form of beauty. I mean, there are some exceptions to that, but I'm thinking of even movies like monster movies like Alien or Predator or Terminator. These are all like these classic cinema monsters, but they're reflecting like an artistry in the production of those images. They're reflecting like an artist's touch in the concept and delivery. Whereas this movie, I felt like everything looks like an animated turd. You know, everything looks like just sloppy. I'm not saying it's bad. I'm not saying that they didn't do a good job. I'm saying that it seems like a choice that, you know, how good can you make a frozen meat monster look? You can't make it look good because it's just going to look like a big pile of ribs and drumsticks and shit. And that's funny and it works, but it's never done in a way that tries to make it look like more than what the concept is. You know, because you could take any monster concept and present it in a way that, you know, is aesthetically pleasing, or you could do it in a way that is almost literal. And I think they did things pretty literally here. I mean, the Korok, for example. I mean, it just looks like shit. It's just a big mass of... It's just a big mass of flesh, and it's like a big pit with an eye in it. And it doesn't... You know, it's freaky. It's just freaky. Because they didn't try to beautify it. You know, because they didn't try to make it, you know, an orb or something. They didn't try to give it symmetry. You know, they didn't try to... It's just a thing. And that's the same with all these monsters in this movie.
That's the honesty you're talking about, I think.
You know,
and I think that's...
I think so.
I mean, it's a way of looking at people and looking at the world, too, of not taking things too seriously, not looking too far into things, too behind things, not trying to, you know, sculpt reality or, like, you know, polish it or whatever you call it, you know, gloss it to really, like, you know, perfect it or turn it into artistry, you know, but rather saying, like, taking it as it is, you know, looking at a person without their makeup or their clothes on, just like balls and hair and, you know, toenails, because that's, I mean, that is reality, and you know, that which is before you, that's it, right? Like, and it's just funny how mixed in with that, you know, that they achieve that kind of honest look at reality by presenting us with, like, turd demons and, like, meat monsters and the, you know, tit brain or whatever Korok is.
And the, that's that spider thing that hangs up on the ceiling and gets in a cage, you know, and it's invisible unless you look out of your eye at it, the side of your eye at it. Like, that thing, I still don't know what it was. I call it a spider because it resembles the form of a spider, but it really was, it was like this wet, mucousy glob, you know? Made insect noises, kind of shrieked and stuff. Yeah. But I didn't recognize anything about it, really, other than just my brain struggled to call it a spider.
That's, I mean, that's an achievement if a movie can show you something genuinely original that doesn't fit any pattern you've seen. To see a monster and not know what to call it is, you know, even the monsters and aliens, like, yeah, it looks like a fucking alien. Or, like, I don't know what other movie you had. Like in Starship Troopers, they're bugs, you know? I get it. But yeah, what the fuck is that thing on the ceiling in John Dies at the End? I have no frame of reference for it at all.
You know, yeah. I think that this movie had, like I mentioned, had an overall mood to it that was campy, that, and to me, harken back to things like Tank Girl. I don't know if you've ever seen Tank Girl, which is based on a graphic novel or a comic series from the 90s. They made a movie late 90s, I think. Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. This romp, I'm almost like meaningless, absurd romp set to us like a, if not a musical soundtrack, a sort of musical palette of that belongs to like a generation, you know, a sort of, I mean, there's a scene in this movie where he's performing, John is performing with his band. And they're clearly playing this sort of punk style,
like late
grunge 90, style,
late 90s
brash
punk music, maybe. Or it reminds me of, like,
yeah,
I don't know what to fucking call it.
It reminds me of a time when that aesthetic, that kind of that music style, that music culture, that was being co-opted by the mainstream. You were seeing it show up in these pretty much low budget but trying to be high concept movie vehicles like Barbed Wire. You ever see Barbed Wire with Pamela Anderson? Also, I believe, based on a comic series. And that's what it reminded me of, these early adaptations of comic series that were, you know, reflecting the subculture that belonged to these stories, or people that identified with seeing their favorite, like, underground comic series become a movie. And you can't take, I mean, these are characters and situations and settings like John Dies at the End or Barbed Wire or Tank Girl or Bill and Ted. I don't know if Bill and Ted was a comic series, but you can roll it into these characters that belong in a comic series. You can buy in, get attached to these characters when you see them in a comic panel, when you see them illustrated, when you see their thoughts and words and word bubbles and stuff. You get attached to them in a way because it's you and them on the page. You get a personal attachment to these characters in a way that doesn't quite translate to watching a person, an actor, try to embody that character on a screen in a room full of other people. Some of that personal connection is lost, and I think some of the potency of the whole narrative and concept is lost, and instead you get this the absurdity or the tongue-in-cheek. Because the endeavor to genuinely, I'm getting totally like abstract now, but the endeavor to genuinely represent something like a graphic novel or maybe even like a serial web series in film is such an inherently flawed endeavor that I think it's easy to then fall back on a tongue-in-cheek sense of humor about doing it, almost as if to say, like, look, we know that this movie is never going to touch the satisfaction you've gotten from reading issue after issue with these characters you love and think about in between reading, you know, that you feel like you have a connection to them because you go out and buy their comic book, or you go and you seek out the next story. This movie that we're making is never going to touch that. I mean, if we're lucky, because it's a totally different format, we've made decisions about what the character's going to sound like, how they're going to behave in real time, that may or may not match what you've chosen. And so, you know, it's like it brings out, I think as a compensation for that, it gets tongue-in-cheek, like, haha, we're all in on the joke now that this is goofy. You know, this is, and I think that's obvious in something like Barbed Wire. I think it's obvious in something like Tank Girl. I mean, it's obvious in something like Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, the movie. These are, you know, they it's almost a little slapstick. And I'm not complaining. I'm just drawing an analogy that this is, it's in the same vein. It hits those sort of tongue-in-cheek, you know, wink wink nod to the audience marks that these other movies have. And I think that speaks, I think maybe that's, you know, maybe that's more indicative of a story, a concept being adapted to the screen that already has following in another format. You know, it knows it's going to have an audience that's already familiar. You know, it's not like I'm hogging the mic.
You finish
here,
your thought.
You want to hear something to say? It knows that it has a built-in audience with a built-in familiarity, and it, you know, maybe that's something we're not used to in film. Maybe we're not used to watching a film that knows we're there in the way that our favorite comic series knows we're there. You know, the intimacy we have with a writer in a series is different than the intimacy that we expect to have with a writer in a one-off film.
Right, I mean, you get certain nods to the audience, the writer knows that the audience has been with them and can throw them certain, you know, tidbits at the street. You don't get that usually in movies, and that's something, not having read the comic book, maybe even though I didn't pick up on that, awareness of me as an audience member still came through really clearly. But a question came up in my mind as you were talking about that, and that's like, what is the purpose of turning this into a movie then? If you'll never achieve the same connection with the audience that you get in the original format, why bother turning it into a one-off movie? I mean, it'd be a different thing if they were turning it into a TV series or something. I mean, I suppose. But yeah. But I mean, even regardless of money, like, why would someone pay money to see the movie if it's never going to be the same kind of connection that they get from the impact that they get from the comic book? But clearly, like, I know from experience that, like, I don't know, like, even the Harry Potter, like, something is where the movies are, like, even, like, pretty bad, you know, for at least in a lot of ways. Or Lord of the Rings, or what, or The Hobbit, or whatever, you know, like, where I read the books and I know, like, damn well, like, the movies aren't going to be as impactful as the books. But why the hell do I want, and Game of Thrones is a great example, you know, like, why do I want to, what's in it for me to go see the movie of it? I mean, like, my imagination is more vivid than the actual screen's ever going to be. My connection with the writer and, like, the actual story is deeper. There's way more detail in the text. But it doesn't change the fact that I don't want to see the fucking movie.
I agree. I think there's a curiosity there. There's an inherent curiosity in wanting to see. I mean, I think we're transfixed with movies culturally, that we still are operating on this idea, a lot of us, myself included, that if a story is getting the movie treatment, then
right,
it must deserve it. Which I don't think is necessarily true. And there's also, and there's not, let's not discount the amount of effort that goes into marketing a movie so
that
we feel we
should
see it.
But I think there's a good reason.
You know, I mean,
though,
it's almost.
I don't think that I'm not willing to believe that, you know, the only value of movies is something that's just been implanted in my brain, created by an advertising company or something. I think I know that it fills some real want. And that it serves some purpose that a book doesn't. And maybe it's just that, yeah, like, my imagination is more vivid than any movie, you know, will ever be. But at the same time, that's still my imagination.
Yeah.
On a gut level, when I'm reading a text, I can never really get out of my own experience. And, like, what I'm experiencing is just, you know, someone else's, you know, what it would be like for me to step into someone else's world, or what it would be like for you know, what it would feel like inside my head to be going through the events that someone else is describing, whereas a movie offers, I mean, the distinguishing feature of a movie is visual and sound, right? Like, sight and sound. Like, that's the difference from a text. Text is all abstract.
Yeah.
It's all concept. The movie adds sensation. I mean, it probably not too long before there's, like, touch and, I don't know, smell to movies. There is at, like, Disney World. And
yeah,
it gives you a chance to experience something totally foreign in a way that can make you aware that there's something greater than yourself. That, like, you know, if a book is a pathway to that, is an internal pathway to that realization of, like, what's beyond yourself, a movie is really stepping outside of anything you've experienced before. To the extent that a movie is effective at being a movie, it presents you with a visual scheme that is totally foreign to you, with things like the weird spider, scorpion, turd, ceiling, monkey, or, like, it, Under the Skin was another great example of that, or any of, like, you know, Stanley Kubrick's films, or like, you know, any director who we respect generally presents us with a visual style that for a lot of people is actually hard to watch because it's so unfamiliar.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that this, to get back to your question about why make this movie, why make any adaptation, but as far as this movie is concerned, I mean, John Dies at the End, I think it was a passion project. I think people that liked or were close to the material worked at doing it. You know, it's micro budget, probably, as far as small as they could be. It didn't really, I mean, Paul Giamatti is the biggest name, and the director has had some successes, you know, other tongue-in-cheek horror comedies like Bubba Hotep. You know, it's just, it's B and C level production. And if the source material for the production value had been any less unique and didn't already have a built-in audience and following, this movie would be straight to DVD, the bottom of the Netflix offerings. It'd be one of those cheesy, forgettable, barely even noticeable horror comedies that you see by the dozen, you know, in DVD racks at Walmart or, you know, on Netflix. They look like knockoffs of other things. But because it already had a built-in following, I think there was a different kind of will to make it than just looking for something to make. I'm glad I saw it, because I've heard talk about it, and I felt like it does reflect. I think it does reflect a time and place in our world, when people are savvy enough with the topics that this movie covers for it to be out there. But there's enough context for the movie to be watchable, you know, as far as quantum physics or psychedelic drugs and psychedelics and psychic experiences. The smorgasbord of paranormal and occult name drops in this movie. You know, there had this movie come out 20, 30 years ago, just there would be no context for it. But because we have we've had the X-Files, we've had a sort of scientific awakening in a way, and we're starting to actually become
parallel
aware
universes
of things like
and
quantum mechanics, and yeah, it's somewhat in the public dialogue that these kind of abstractions, although they're still outliers, they're almost like anticipated to be.
So that's interesting.
More
I
common.
Mean, when you talk about it that way, I kind of start to really wonder what the existence of a movie like this and the casual nature of those kind of references, what that says, you know, if that's an indicator of, you know, reality of like what we can expect to realistically happen in the foreseeable future. I mean, if you look at, you know, a movie 100 years ago, or I don't know, a book maybe 100 years ago, or like a Jules Verne book, in the way that, you know, anticipated real accomplishments, or that movies that, you know, or in books that anticipated, you know, gene cloning or gene therapy, or a lot of the topics in the X-Files that were kind of on the edges and have actually become like real things that are really happening in real labs, and that we accept now as like, wow, okay, gene therapy like that actually is real, like we do that, or cloning, like that's been done. And if that's not, you know, if the fact of this movie isn't a nod to the, or an indicator that we're actually going to see people tap into parallel universes in the relatively near future. I mean, according to Stephen Hawking, that's like a, you know, real thing. That's
I just hope we don't come up with talking dogs or time loops or ghosts or people with like mustaches that detach and fly
around
the
room. Yeah, giant, you know, tit brains that make dick jokes.
I think that'd be a good place
I think that's a good idea.
To end it, what do you think?
I've said tit,
for the sake of, for the sake
tit
of keeping
brain about 12 times by now.
The
so
shorter
I,
side.
That's right.
Yeah. So we hit the quota. Yeah. I think I
think
we wanted
some of them
to get
like
10,
to edit it out.
We went over
so
a little bit.
Feel free. Feel free to remove anything I say in the editing.
So,
by the way. I think that's right. You should
remove
really
everything you say. Just be me. I mean, just me responding. What were you doing today when I
went to a farmer's
you
market
from
this morning to a table for AmeriCorps. That was a blast. I got back and did some writing, and then went outside to talk to Christopher, the landowner or co-owner of the land, about the possibility of buying a magic school bus and living in that, parking that on the land and living inside of it, and whether that would effectively reduce our cost of living or not. And we're exploring the options. It's some things to think about, the biggest one being how we're gonna get our water in there, if we're going to have running water or not, and if we do have running water, how we're gonna keep it from freezing, and what the cost of that would be. And it sounds, after talking to him, reasonable that we could do it and we would be saving money. The question is, you know, there's some effort involved in it, and is that the most bang for our buck? You know, the, because we'll certainly lose some conveniences.
Yeah.
It's going to be a smaller space. It's a long story.
So, I mean, Maine doesn't strike me as a, or is it like a trailer park?
Oh, it's like
part of the country. As far as hookup utilities,
we could live in a trailer park, but I don't want to do that.
I mean, well, I mean, how do trailer parks solve that problem?
Heated lines. Water, so that's something that we could do. I have an underground line. Well, generally there'd be an underground water line, which that solves the problem because ground generally doesn't freeze. You hope. The other option is you have a line coming from the house with heat tape around it, but that would just have to be drained. The other option is you just keep your fucking trailer at 40 degrees all winter long, which there's a cost associated with that. But, you know.
Yeah.
It's well insulated. It might not be that expensive.
Huh. But, I mean, how much does it... I assume you also want a magic school bus because you want to be able to pack up and leave.
That's a plus, is traveling across country and painting a big sign on it that says, you know, need anything, call this phone number.
do you see that happening?
Sure.
Do you see, like, that... having the money, because I imagine that's got to be expensive, driving that thing. I mean, driving a vehicle that is also a dwelling seems not...
Oh, certainly not.
Efficient.
It's a fun way. It would be a cool way to travel, I think.
So
it depends if the cost of lodging, like if we're going to Disney World, for instance, where it's expensive to just exist there, having a trailer makes that a lot cheaper potentially.
But I mean, how much would it cost to get you there?
But I don't know that the chief attraction of the school bus is that it's movable. Yeah. It's that it's been remodeled, insulated and wood paneled, and it's like a basically like a nice house that was a nice, very small house that was able to be built inexpensively because someone used the fucking school bus instead of having to build a frame and walls and all that shit. And it moves.
Yeah. I gotcha. I mean, I don't disagree with that, but I also feel like, obviously, now you can cheaply build something of comparable size.
That's what...
and quality.
That's
and
sort
price
of what I'm thinking, too. Like, that's
from
where
scratch.
That's what I was saying, like, if that's the best bang for our buck, like we could probably for cheaper just get a shipping container and build our house out of that, or build another Cobb cabin.
Right.
Like, why not?
Yeah. Why, like, pigeonhole yourself into living in
mainly because
bus frame? Even if it's been renovated, it might have really cool windows and stuff, but it's still a bus. I'm not complaining. I think it's... I mean, I really don't... I don't want to make a judgment on it because it definitely would be cool. But it seems like the kind of maybe not best suited for Maine.
Right.
At least not Maine winters. Like if you were living on like the beach somewhere in that. Or, you know, someplace more with a warmer climate, then not so many other considerations to keep in mind when it comes to housing.
That's true.
Yeah. Hell, I would do that. If I was living, you know, somewhere warmer and I had that as an option, I would take it.
Yeah.
Definitely. But the idea of like living in it in the winter with the snow seems like punishment.
Yeah, you're probably right.
You know?
Mm. Yeah. So, just considering our options, I guess. But trying to think creatively about how we're going to deal with our living situation. You know, $600 a month is low rent, but still, you know, a lot of money we could be saving.
True.
And certainly living in Maine, the biggest potentials are cost reduction, not income. Not increasing income. So.
Well, good talk, Saul.
Yeah, likewise, Adrian.
We'll have to pick another movie to talk about.
Yeah, I'm planning to watch Barbed Wire and Tank Girl, since you referenced them a couple times.
Yeah, they're worth it. I don't know if I've sat through all of Barbed Wire.
I just wanted to watch that because Pamela Anderson's in it.
I remember being in, you know, fourth or fifth grade when it came out, and that was at the height of her fame. And of course, you know, every boy was just beside themselves with her as an entity.
Right. All right, entity.
And John dies at the end. It's not a spoiler. It's just the name.
Yeah.